The servants were there, for it was a holiday weekend. I fixed the tea and brought it down the corridor. Everything was silent. My footsteps, the snow sifting down the empty streets. There was a clock in the parlor, and I could hear it as if it were a beating heart. When I neared the bedchamber, I heard Dr. Hades' voice. "Does your chest ache when you breathe?" "There are birds outside the window," Frederick said. Dr. Hades went to pull back the curtains. Flakes of snow hit against the glass and stuck in patterns that looked like clouds. Snow was wedged to the branches of the plane trees that lined our street. "There are no birds," he said. But from where I stood, I saw the three blackbirds. I went to the window and opened it, even though the wind came through and snow dotted the floor. I shouted at the birds and gestured with my arms until Dr. Hades pulled me back and closed the window. I sat in a chair shivering while he drew the curtains. I took the tea to Frederick, but he waved it away. "Darling," he said. He recognized me. "You see them out there, don't you?" Perhaps the yellow fever he had after arriving in St. Thomas damaged his liver and spleen, Dr. Hades told me when we went into the hall. The doctor said he'd given my husband quinine, made from the bark of a tree from South America, which had not been freely available when Frederick was a young man. For this medicine to be effective, however, it needed to be given immediately after the illness became present, not years later. And then there was the growth in his abdomen, perhaps the cancer of the stomach. It was too late to remove any tissue for study, for Frederick was too weak for anything so invasive. The doctor told me to keep my husband cool when the fever came, and have him drink the tea every hour. He refused to accept a fee. "You are family to us," he said. "I am here whenever you need me." I soon realized that the doctor's tea was a narcotic of some sort, not meant to cure but to ease the process of dying. My husband's lean, strong body and his fluid energy had disappeared. He faltered more every hour. Still, there was a gleam of response when I got into bed beside him. We twined around each other, and I breathed into his mouth so that my soul might strengthen his, but it did no good. I wept for the young man in my kitchen, his fine features, his eyes elusive, as if he feared to look at me. But he did look, and now he opened his eyes. He still knew me. No one else had known me as he had. It took 3 days. Justine or Liddy came to sit with me. The fevers grew worse, and the chills were so terrible nothing I did seemed to warm him. On the third day I sent for Camille. He came immediately, smelling of snow and paint. He was thinner than before, his beard longer, his clothes fitting for a peasant. I made no mention of any of this and allowed him to kiss me 3 times. He had brought a handful of hyacinth, the same flower I'd had with me when I knew my husband would die. They were deep purple and smelled of both spring and snow. "You should have called for me sooner." My son threw off his coat and went to stand at the foot of the bed. He called to his father, but Frederick seemed very far away and he would not respond. "Is this the end, then?" Camille asked me. I could see how shaken he was. "Is there no hope?" "There is always hope," Adele had told me so long ago, when I was so unhappy with my life after I married the first time. Much to my surprise, it had turned out to be true. Now it was a lie, but I could not tell my son otherwise. Frederick slept in the grip of his fever, his breathing labored. The sound of him straining for air reminded me of the sound of the wind that came across the sea from Africa before the rains began. I hadn't changed my clothes in days, or washed, or had a meal, or left the room. Perhaps Camille noticed my distress, for his expression changed. He pulled over a chair and sat next to me.
"Did you know that Father and I once went to a waterfall and threw off our clothes and dove in together? He told me if I held out my hands, little fish would come to me, and they did. It was near the same place I once found a skeleton nearly hidden by the tall grass."
"I know that place."
I was glad to envision it. The pool I had passed on the way to the herb man, whose death my son had foreseen when he was just an infant who refused to sleep. "We went swimming the day we chased off Madame Halévy's daughter."
I looked at Camille, surprised to hear this. I hadn't known my husband had been a party to that. made me love him even more.
I've kept Madame's ring to remind me of that day. I've kept her story secret for her, but there's no real cause to do so anymore.
I nodded. She was a great one for secrets.
She told me that your cousin Aaron was her grandson. Her daughter abandoned him because the father was African.
I think you're wrong, I told him. Yet I remembered Madame Halevy at the door late one night when I thought she was a witch standing in our courtyard.
Your mother had lost a son, and so the two made a pact. Your mother would raise the child in our faith, and no one would ever know the truth about Madame Halevy's daughter. When he fell in love with Justine, they told him he mustn't marry her. Such a marriage would only bring his origins into question. These two ladies were the ones who thought it best for Lydia to be raised in France, where she would be considered a member of our faith. They were the ones who arranged for her to be taken. They thought they were doing the right thing for all concerned, but they were not.
My son tugged off Madame Halevy's ring. He'd worn it for so long it had left an indentation in his flesh. When he took my hand in his palm was as rough as any working man's. He seemed older than his years because of his long beard. He painted in the fresh cold air and his complexion was weather-beaten. I thought of how I'd carried him through the woods when he couldn't sleep, how he was the only one of my babies I had told my stories to. I'd loved him too much even then. I saw Frederic in him, his lanky, dignified posture, his resolve to do the right thing, his strong features.
I had pity for Madame Halevy, he told me. That was the world she lived in, but it isn't ours. Give the ring to Justine. Tell her Aaron Rodriguez wanted her to have it. He just never had the chance to give it to her.
My son sat with me through the night. When morning came, the bright streaks of daylight were haint blue, but in this country that color couldn't keep ghosts away. My husband died that day at noon. It might as well have been midnight, for the heavy damask drapes were drawn and the room was pitch. I did not want to look out and see Paris, the city of my beloved's death. The world was silenced by snow, but in the dark I could imagine vines of cloudy pink bougainvillea and bees rumbling through the blossoms, and the young man blinking back sunlight as he stared into my window. His last words to me were, "I am no longer with you."
I did my best to tear down the curtain between death and the living world, to ensure that light and breath would enter into my husband once more. I breathed into his mouth and pounded on his chest. I called to him, but he didn't return. He was gone from me.
There was a small service at the cemetery. Camille was there with my kitchen maid and their little boy. When it came time to move the coffin into the ground, I would not allow it. There were wood doves nesting nearby, and they all took flight when I began to scream. We had hired a rabbi, an old man who wore a broad, black-brimmed hat and said the morning prayers for a fee. When I could not be held away from the casket, he retreated as if I were Lilith herself, the witch who came for unnamed babies and never let them go. She had talons at the ends of her fingers and 1,000 golden rings, all sacrifices from women who had tried to bribe her. But no payment would do. I held on to the coffin and banged on it. I heard an echo and thought my husband had been brought back to life by a miracle. I was not one to give up easily, no matter who my enemy might be, even death. I heard my son's voice then, as his strong arms pulled me back. "He is gone. And all we have is this world, here and now." For several weeks afterward, I did not leave my room. I took the laudanum that was prescribed to me, 10 drops at a time and then 20. When that was not enough, I had the coachman bring me more, from where I did not ask. I slept all day and night for good reason. In my dreams, I could go back in time. That was what I wanted. The place I'd always hated, I longed for desperately now. Every night I dreamed of sitting in the kitchen while Adele fixed our lunch. I was out in the yard where the chickens came to me when I clucked at them. There were green moths at my window and red flowers in a vase. I was wearing a white slip made of cotton and the sunlight was blinding. I could not open my eyes because of it. There were parrots in the trees, a sign of luck, the luck I had given away. A man was walking through the door and my heart was so loud I couldn't hear anything else. Justine came and insisted upon opening the drapes. A dim light fell in bands across the room, but I protested even that. I did not wish to see the world, or step into it, or know it, without Frederic. We were one person, or so it had been, and now without him I was nothing. A girl who was waiting for her life to change. An old woman who cared about nothing but what she had lost. Camille came to see me, but I kept my back to him. He found my blue notebook in my bureau and began to read to me during his visits. He told me about a donkey with the name of a Frenchman whom I love so well I gave him bread mixed with milk for breakfast, and of an apple tree that never grew any bigger, and a bird that flew around the world searching for love. He added stories of his own, of an old lady who rescued a baby from drowning in the rain, of people who were in love but kept apart. He brought colored pencils and illustrated my stories, and sometimes when he left I would study them. I cried when I saw how beautiful our world had been as seen through my son's eyes, and my tears brought me back to life. Justine made me fongi and insisted I eat. She then brought out my black mourning dress, the one I'd packed in St. Thomas and had worn to every funeral except my husband's. On that day I'd refused to wear anything more than a white slip under his long black coat. Justine pressed the mourning dress with lavender water, then she combed my hair. Nothing had turned out as we thought it would. I gave Justine the gold ring that should have been her wedding band. "From Aaron," I said, "since you were the one he loved." We had grown up in a world rimmed with hurt, where a lie was easier to tell than the truth. Later that day I heard Justine crying in the garden. It was cold and there were no birds, only the sound of her immense sorrow. What we had lost, we could never regain. I sat in the parlor, and when Justine came inside, she no longer had the ring. She had buried it under a rose bush, using her bare hands to dig deeply enough. Every day as the weather grew warmer, we sat on wicker chairs and watched the leaves greening. In April, the war in the States was over, and there was a great celebration in our city. But then the news came that Lincoln had been shot on April 14th. Black banners and buntings were hung on houses and shops. By the end of the month, the buds that appeared on the rose bushes were white. They were alba roses, but we called them rose de neige, snow roses. We told each other that when they bloomed, our hearts would be mended. But on the 1st of May, when the roses opened, they were red, and we still carried our pain. We then understood we would carry it forever. We had planned to cut the roses when they bloomed and keep them in vases, but we left them. They reminded us of the gardens in St. Thomas. Just as I suspected, 1,000 bees appeared one day and drank their fill. Later that month, I received a card from my son announcing that he and Julie had had another child, a daughter, born on May 13th, whom they had named Jean Rachel. Jean for Julie's mother, Rachel after me. I had done many things that I regretted, and I had all but lost my son, just as Justine had predicted. So I took his naming of the baby to be a message to me. I thought about the first Madame Petite who had refused to die until her baby was named. What you are called marks you and makes you who you are. Despite my disagreements with the parents, I put aside my bitterness. This baby was mine. When Justine suggested we go to see my namesake, having figured out how I might avoid the mother, I quickly agreed. My friend had persuaded Lydia and Henri Cohen to invite my son and Julie to lunch, to discuss financial matters, for I had placed Henri in charge of my finances. I still supported my son's family, so he agreed to this appointment. On that same day, Justine and I took the train from Paris to the railway crossing at La Patrie near Pontoise. Then we walked, for my son and his family lived in a farmhouse outside of town. We took a beautiful old looping road bordered by purple blooms scattered through the tall grass. I realized it was lavender, which I took to be a good sign. I was wearing black boots with buttons that made for good walking shoes, and my black morning dress and also Frederic's black woolen coat, even though the day was unseasonably warm. I did not imagine I would ever wear another color. As we approached the farmhouse, I fell silent. Justine understood that I was nervous. The sky was dull and the clouds were low. We held hands so we wouldn't stumble on the muddy road. As we neared the house, we noticed there were chickens running free in the yard. Justine laughed. "Don't kill anything," she warned me. "I'm too old," I informed her. "Don't be silly. Old women are the fiercest ones of all."
We chuckled as we traipsed along, our skirts dragging. Madame Halevy had told me I wouldn't begin to understand the world until I was her age. Witches are made, not born. That was what she'd whispered to me on that night my son brought us to her house for dinner. Remember that, she'd said before I left. Remember me. We knocked on the back door as if we were expected guests, and ignored the protests of the kitchen maid, who was startled to find two old ladies calling and did her best to put us off. We said we were too tired to be turned away and demanded tea before the poor woman could question us about our intentions. When steaming mugs of tea and small lemon tarts had been offered and accepted, the maid explained that her employers and their little boy had gone to Paris for the day. She didn't have the authority to entertain guests and might find herself in trouble if her mistress discovered she'd allowed strangers into the house. I threw Justine a knowing look. The original kitchen maid was now an employer with a long list of do's and don'ts. We assured the maid we were well-meaning, there to see the new member of the family, and that we had traveled too far to turn heel and leave. Now that we were inside, I took the opportunity to evaluate my son's situation. The house was rough-hewn, but not without charm. A good thing, since I was paying for it. My son the anarchist had no trouble letting the money from our family business pay his bills. When the maid had been convinced we were harmless, we were brought into the parlor where lovely lace curtains had been hung over the windows. There was the baby in the cradle. "Do they call her Rachel or Jean?" I asked the maid. I hoped it wasn't Jean, the name of her other grandmother, the one who tended orchards near Dijon and likely plucked chickens each evening for a stew. "They call her Minette." I was pleased to hear this. It was a pet name for a little cat. They could call her whatever they wanted as long as they didn't call her Jean. As far as I was concerned, her name was Rachel. I wished either Justine or I could have remembered the words Adele recited to protect a child from harm, but neither of us could recall her prayer. I wished Frederic had been beside me. I still talked to him inside my head, and so I told him now how happy this visit had made me. My namesake was a beautiful child with dark eyes. I believe she recognized me when I stood over her cradle. I told her about the butterflies who created a second moon of light, and of blue birds as tall as people, and of a woman who swam away from the cruelties of humankind. I brought a gift for her, my mother's diamond earrings. I left them on a tray beside my son's easel with a brief note. De Rachel à Rachel. From Rachel to Rachel. Most likely he would think the jewels wasteful, silly, extravagant things, and would sell them in order to pay his bills. Perhaps that was what they had been meant for all along when my mother sewed them into the hem of her dress. I brought a gift for the household as well, a basket of apples. But as we left the house, I noticed there was an orchard just beside the house. We picked apples to eat on the train ride home. The light was deep and gray and the fields were purple, exactly as my son painted them. Not long afterward, I moved to smaller lodgings in the 9th arrondissement. Our apartment had always been too large, and I had found myself going from room to room as if searching for my husband. My new lodging happened to be close to my son's studio, and an apartment he rented for the nights he spent in Paris, while the mother of his children cared for their home. The children came to me on Thursdays. I marked that day of the week on my calendar with a star. Camille carried the baby and held the little boy by the hand. He reminded me so much of Frederic, for he had the same sort of tenderness with his children.
"They're not too much for you," Camille asked.
He called the darling little boy Marmotte, Sleepyhead, the same name I had used for him.
"They won't tire you."
"Do you think I'm ancient?" I said.
"I do," the little boy said. 100 years old. You're a very old goat."
I laughed despite myself.
I liked the boy who broke the rules.
"Did you teach him to be so polite?" I asked my son.
"Or maybe your mother told you I was a goat," I said to my grandson, who laughed and hid behind his father, peeping out every now and then with a grin on his face. "Be nice to your grandmother."
Camille leaned down to kiss the little boy on his head.
"They adore coming here," he told me.
"Why shouldn't they?" I said. Camille laughed and kissed me 3 times, as we used to do on St. Thomas.
"Don't let them tire you out."
My son left the children early in the morning and returned after his day of work at his studio. I assume their mother appreciated a day to see to her bustling household without the children underfoot. She didn't mind the old goat when it came to caring for them. So much the better. I liked to sit with them in the parlor in the afternoons and tell them stories. I took out my blue notebooks, which I'd stored away for so long. My darling granddaughter was only a baby, but my grandson listened to every word I told him, eyes wide. I told him about the werewolves, who couldn't count to 100, about fish who could become horses on dry land, about a donkey named Jean-Francois who could speak.
"No, he couldn't," my grandson responded with certainty. "Donkeys don't talk. We have one. My mother says feed a donkey hay and he'll be happy."
I shrugged. "Maybe that's true in France. In St. Thomas, donkeys talk."
"In English?" he asked.
I saw that I'd won him over, despite what his mother had told him. That gave me hope for the future. "In French," I informed him. My grandson nodded, pleased. This made sense to him. He was a charming, practical boy. He took his nap very well, my marmotte, and lay down on my settee so I could cover him with a green silk blanket.
"I'm in the ocean," he said to me.
"Swim into your dreams," I said as I dimmed the light. When my pretty little namesake fussed, I lay down on the bed beside her. She was not a good sleeper, but she was a good listener, with lovely dark eyes and a mouth like a rose. I told her the story about the woman who lived with the turtles, the one who had followed me across the sea just under the ship. All across the ocean she had slept with her long pale arms wrapped around the anchor. She ate fish and clams, she avoided sunlight, and swam just below the surface of the waves. She came near when she heard music on board from a string quartet that was traveling to Paris. She came even closer when the captain displayed his art collection of watercolors in shades of apricot and rose and yellow, all human colors that she could never find at sea. One day, a passenger's dress was missing, and that evening I spied a skirt floating in the water, a silky thing that rose and fell with the tides. The woman who lived with turtles could not make the choice between our worlds, and at night I saw 100 of her companions floating farther out in the ocean, their green shells like stepping stones. The baby was often asleep on my bed when her father came for the children at the close of the day. He said it was a wonder how well his daughter slumbered when she was in my care. I told him that babies needed to sleep in order to dream. I believe my namesake dreamed of 1,000 small miracles and that she dreamed of the turtle woman from our homeland. When he arrived for the children, my son smelled of turpentine. He couldn't wash it away. He was considered to be famous now, although still a radical, and the other radicals who admired him wished to have his paintings for free. Every month I wrote him a check, just as I'd always done. Not that he was a spendthrift. Far from it. He wore old clothes that hung on his thin frame and favored boots with restitched soles. He'd rather eat an apple than have an expensive meal in a cafe. More than anything, he was a family man. He was a good father and a good husband. He was intent on marrying my kitchen maid, but he still wanted my blessings. I understood. I'd wanted the same thing myself. Perhaps that was why he allowed me to spend so much time with the children, or perhaps it was simply because he could see my deep love for them. For now, I would let them wait for my approval, but eventually I would have to give in for the sake of these darling children. I gave them fungi porridge for dinner every Thursday. I had hired a cook from St. Thomas named Annabeth, who remembered all the old recipes. She could even make a mixture that tasted like a guava berry rum by using local strawberries. It was a comfort to have her around, plus she was an excellent baker. Every now and then she made a coconut cake that I brought to share with the Cohens.
"Don't you want something better than porridge for your family?"
Annabeth often said to me on Thursdays, but no, I didn't want anything more. When I told Justine about the cook's remarks, she laughed. She, too, made fungi for her grandchildren. It was good for the body and the spirit, as it had been long ago. On warm evenings, Justine and I often walked along the river. It was nearly summer and Frederic had been gone for several months. Still, he came to me in my dreams. He lay down beside me, entwined with me, and I could hear the sound of bees. Time was moving so quickly. Soon it would be July, and the sky would be blue, and heat would rise off the gravel paths in the Tuileries in radiant waves. I brought the roses in my garden with me to my new address and planted them in a courtyard. As the season went on, they would grow pale, withering in the bright sunlight, and then, if they were carefully pruned and watered, they would have a second flowering in August. Justine and I would sit in the wicker chairs and watch to see whether they bloomed red or white. We liked the quiet of the river and often took the path along the Seine. Paris was never a disappointment, although often we talked about the weather back home and how we could sit out all night long and never once be chilled, how when the rain came down I kept my window open. One evening, as we were strolling, the weather changed suddenly, surprising us, as it did on our island when the wind came from Africa. All at once there was a driving green rain so cold we shivered. This was not the rain of our island. Here it fell like a curtain. We could barely see as we plunged into a tunnel and stood there laughing in the dark. We'd run so swiftly we were out of breath. I was wearing my feathered hat and Frederick's black coat. I was never without it. I wondered what I would do once the summer was upon us. Perhaps I would wear his shirt, the one I slept in now, beneath my clothes and close to my heart. We couldn't stay in the tunnel forever, so we darted into the rain, holding Frederick's coat above our heads as we'd once held up leaves to be our umbrellas. Now it was the leaves from the chestnut trees that were drifting down, sticking to the pavement, a slick, coppery carpet. Eventually the rain became a pale, cold drizzle. Everything was so green, the way it was when we hid in the tall grass, unnoticed by everyone but the yellow birds darting above us. We found a painted wooden bench for ourselves and swept off the rain with our hands. The leaves on the shrubs turned silver as dusk crossed the sky. The grass was purple. We were so still, none of the passers-by noticed us as they hurried along the wet gravel, intent on being on their way. Justine and I had practiced silence on the nights when we waited for the turtles. In the tall grass, we could disappear if we wanted to. We could watch the hillsides turn red one flower at a time. We had seen so much, but we had never seen the turtle girl until now. She was there in the river. The woman who had spent a lifetime with the turtles, but had arms and legs as we did, and long moss-black hair she had wound into morning plaits. She'd come across the sea from the place that was our home, alongside our ship. I'd seen her footsteps on the bow of the boat and in the hallways of our building. All over Paris, lanterns were burning. It was the hour when the haint-blue sky dissolved into darkness and the bats flew above us. We watched the woman between worlds climb out of the water and walk through the park. Our sister, who could not decide whether or not to be human, sat down with us at last.
Afterward. Rachel Pizarro's life in My Imagined Story mirrors the known facts about her as closely as possible. Rachel Monsanto Pommier Petit Pizarro was born in 1795 on St. Thomas, where her father, Moses Monsanto Pommier, was a prominent merchant, having fled in the 1790s from Saint-Domingue during the revolution there. They were Danish citizens whose families had come from Spain, Portugal, and France. In 1818, Rachel married Isaac Petit, a French Jew of Murano heritage. He had previously been married and had 8 children with his first wife, Esther. 3 were surviving when Rachel became their stepmother. By the time Isaac died in 1824 at the age of 50, he and Rachel had 3 more children together and 1 born after his death. In 1825, Frederic Pizarro, then 22, came to St. Thomas to run the family business. He and Rachel fell instantly in love, despite the community disapproval and the synagogue's refusal to marry them because of their family connection. Despite the scandal created by their relationship, which was considered highly improper, they eventually married and became the parents of 4, including Jacob Abraham Camille Pizarro, who was to become one of the fathers of Impressionism. The stories of the Pizarro's West Indian employees, neighbors, and friends are invented, although Moses Pamier was said to have been carried to safety in a basket, much like his biblical namesake, by a slave who traveled with him when he fled to St. Thomas. Rachel Pizarro is thought to have brought a maid who was a freed slave with her when she came to Paris at the age of 60, never again returning to St. Thomas. Once in Paris, Pizarro, who changed to the more French spelling in 1882, studied with Corot and attended the Académie Suisse, where he met Claude Monet. He was then introduced to Pierre-Auguste Renoir, Alfred Sisley, and Frédéric Bazzi, and later to Paul Gauguin. He became a father figure as well as a mentor to Cézanne. He fell in love with Julie Vallée, a maid in his parents' home. His family disapproved because of her social class and religion and never accepted her. In 1870, the Pizarros fled to London to avoid the Franco-Prussian War, with Rachel, now widowed, living close enough to see her grandchildren, to whom she was devoted. Camille and Julie wed there in 1871. Pizarro had asked for Rachel's permission to wed. She wrote letters giving and then retracting her consent. When Camille and Julie returned to France, they found their house had been used as a slaughterhouse and was in ruins. 1,500 of Pizarro's paintings had been destroyed. Several of Monet's stored there were destroyed as well. Rachel continued to help support the family throughout her lifetime. In 1874, Pizarro's beloved daughter Minette, of whom he painted several moving portraits, and who was named Jean Rachel for her grandmother's, tragically died at the age of 9 due to a respiratory infection. In all, Julie and Camille had 8 children, 2 of whom died. Rachel Monsanto Pamier Petit Pizarro died in Paris in 1889 at the age of 94. Toward the end of her life, she was cared for by Julie, although she still refused to fully accept her as a daughter-in-law. It's interesting to note that when Julie's oldest son decided to become an artist, Julie was said to react much as Rachel had when her son had the same desire, with displeasure and the hope he would find a more reasonable career. She knew how her husband and family had struggled financially, forced to depend on her mother-in-law. Her son did not listen to her and became a well-known painter. Pizarro left his Jewish heritage behind, perhaps because of the stigma and stress placed on his parents and their family when they were ostracized from their community in St. Thomas. His mother warned him against being political when he thought of fighting in the Franco-Prussian War. "You are not French," she is said to have told him. "Don't do anything rash." But in 1894, during the Dreyfus Affair, Pizarro could no longer avoid the issue of his background. Captain Alfred Dreyfus was convicted by a military court of treason for allegedly passing French secrets to German intelligence. Evidence pointed to Dreyfus's innocence, but France became divided into 2 camps, those who supported the military and those who wanted justice for the Jewish captain. Monet and Pizarro supported the search for the truth. Against Dreyfus were some of Pizarro's oldest friends, including Cézanne, Degas, and Renoir. The affair became laced with anti-Semitism. When Émile Zola wrote his famous essay J'accuse in 1898, anti-Jewish riots broke out. Pizarro wrote him a letter of admiration for his act of bravery. Degas and Renoir continued to shun Pizarro and did not attend his funeral. Camille Pizarro's childhood and school years spent with working people and the children of slaves formed his political and personal attitudes. As an outcast, he was sympathetic to those who were rejected by society. Pizarro thought of himself as an anarchist and an atheist, and lived his life as an artist and a working man, an outsider who did not let anything but his art define him. He never returned to the West Indies, but the island of St. Thomas and the people he knew there influenced his art, his philosophy, and his life. He died in Paris in November 1903, the same year the Louvre bought 2 of his paintings. He is considered to be one of the greatest artists of the 20th century. The Marriage of Opposites was written by Alice Hoffman. Tina Benko read the part of Rachel. Gloria Rubin was the narrator. And Santino Fontana was Camille Passaro. It was recorded by Kevin Mazur at Simon & Schuster Audio and Alan Tobin at CBM Sound Studios. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Michael Noble. The Marriage of Opposites was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Marriage of Opposites is available in print from Simon & Schuster. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio by Alice Hoffman, The Dove Keepers, read by Aya Cash, Tova Feldshuh, Jessica Hecht, and Heather Lind. And The Museum of Extraordinary Things, read by Judith Light, Grace Gummer, and Zach Appleman.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.